You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us on Table for Two. We've done 25 incredible interviews this year with some of the world's most fascinating people. We've shared delicious food, intimate stories, and a few glasses of rosé at wonderful restaurants in LA and New York. Today, we're looking back at some of the best moments from the first season of the podcast. When we come together for a meal with our guest, our conversations naturally drift towards some of the same big topics: their lives growing up, harnessing creativity, and how they broke through to success. So, if it's lunchtime where you are, grab something to eat, and of course, a glass of rosé, and enjoy some highlights from our first season. We'll be back soon with even more interviews and great meals. I'm Bruce Bozzi, and this is my podcast, Table for Two. We've had some fantastic interviews this year, and we've sat down for lunch with everyone from Mindy Kaling to Jon Bon Jovi to Sienna Miller. Are you going to take that home? I mean, you kind of should. Protein is protein.
I feel like I can't leave the Sunset Tower with a doggy bag from this. I feel like it's not a good look. Although I would do that if you weren't here.
When you're up there and you are looking at 80,000 people, what are you looking at? Numbers never mattered to me. I wanted to be great for 15 or 50,000. I always just wanted to be the best I could possibly be. In a club, I wanted to kill you. In a stadium, I still want to kill you.
You're the one who said, maybe some people are just douchebags. And I thought it was I knew I loved you in that moment. I said, oh, he's my friend forever.
Today
we're here
at Via Carota,
a very nice restaurant.
And I love that you love it, too.
Oh, my goodness, I love it here.
I mean, the minute I said I was having lunch with Bette Midler, the waiter, Michael, is like, yeah.
Yeah, I come here all the time.
You
the
do.
Food is really good.
No, I call you the Brad Pitt of American historians, just so
I
you
like
know.
That.
We
Thank
are
you.
Sitting with Doug Brinkley, the Brad Pitt of American historians.
You know, I'm a problem solver.
You are a problem solver.
I'm a person that gets that stuff off my desk. Mm-hmm. If someone's doing something that's just bullshit, I'm like the person that calls bullshit.
Right.
We are very close. We were all 16, 18 months apart.
Right.
Five sets of hot curlers, five sets of, you know what I mean? Boxes of Tampax everywhere. Right. Like our whole house was curlers and Tampax
right.
and pantyhose.
Curlers, Tampax, and pantyhose. That's the memoir. That's the name of your memoir.
Oh, my God.
I always say in the advocacy work that I do now, you have to wake up every day optimistic.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have a lot of downtime and a lot of downturns and a lot of no's, mm-hmm. but you have to just keep pushing forward.
Yeah.
There's this little bandstand from kind of a guest house at Ringo's, and they're celebrating the birthday, and suddenly there's David Gilmour, Eric Clapton, Don Henley, Glenn Frey, Joe Walsh, Paul McCartney. And Paul McCartney grabs the mic and says, we're naming this band the Beagles, right?
there's something I read that you said, which is what this is all about. And I'm going to read it.
Okay.
It's abbreviated, but you said, happiness to me is good conversation and lots of laughter.
Yeah.
That's what we're having today.
Right. That I usually have that with you anytime I see you.
We do.
Because you like to be peed on, huh? What? Kid from Orange County. We don't know about that. I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, you're wearing a yellow bandana. That means you like to be peed on.
Ricardo, we are done. He has dipped and dunked his bread into my pasta. Yeah. Into his pasta.
I may not go to dinner.
You have to come to dinner.
Yeah, so you can get the table.
No. I mean, did you hear that? Well, he has to come to dinner so we get a table. Absolutely not.
Are you having a rosé? God, how divine.
This is
I love
crazy.
You, and we're having lunch every single day.
Okay, my pleasure.
And dinner and breakfast. Right.
Yeah. Which means now we're going to be a couple, just
yes,
so you
yes,
know.
It is on.
Let's dive into some longer stories as well. Our guests' early experiences are pivotal to the actors, writers, and designers they've become. In this section, we'll hear from Matthew Broderick, John Hamm, Chelsea Handler, and Rita Wilson. What was it like growing up in New York City, your kid New York?
Yeah.
Which was different, you know, than it is now for your kids.
Yeah, it sure was. Let's see, I grew up on Washington Square North.
I know, I can't believe yeah. that. I always think of you when I pass by that street. It's a series of brownstones.
Yeah, yeah. We were in the beautiful. One, not brownstone, the one like apartment, shabby apartment building on that block. Was us. But I was born on 9th Street and 5th Avenue in a very small apartment with my two, we were all in one room, me and my two sisters.
Wow, you were born in?
No, okay. I was born in a hospital.
I was going to say.
But I was taken in my blanket to 9th Street until I was
wow.
4. And then I moved, the big move was to Washington, was 2 blocks down 5th.
Okay.
And then we had our own bedroom.
Right.
So that's where I really grew up. The village was, the park was, there was bongos and drums all day. You'd hear, you know, we had some windows facing the park.
Yeah.
There was a lot of music all the time. There was less, like, rules.
Right,
it was
definitely.
Open all night.
Yep. Stuff was going
it
down
was crazy,
in that park.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't. And because you faced the park, when it got dark, it was dark on the other side. It's like normally there's two sides of the street that have lights, so
right.
it could get a little dicey.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you get mugged?
I got mugged often, all through the village.
Really?
I've been mugged all over the village.
Did you really?
And Times Square area.
Come on.
Upper West Side.
Yeah. Explain to the listener, because I got mugged once on 3rd Avenue, and they were like, we're going to shove your head through this like
that's
window.
Nice. That's
give us
nice.
When I had like $5. It was like 19.
You know, I never had any money, and people were constantly wanted it. Yeah.
What was the target over you that you think that you were constantly getting mugged?
I think a young guy, you know, this is like, I'm talking like 12, you know.
Right, yeah.
That's
no,
when it happened
that's
a
it.
Lot.
Yeah, me too.
And it was mostly other boys, you know,
yes.
just being bullies.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting money, you know, lunch money or something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
But sometimes somewhat scary.
Yeah.
You know, me and my friend Garrow were skateboarding in Central Park once. And a massive gang came flying out and took our skateboards. And I got whacked in the head with some sort of stick. That's the only time I got kind of
wow.
hurt. So, you know, it was not a joke.
Yeah.
And thank God, you know, we all survived it. But and most of them were not like that. They were more intimidating. I'm
yeah.
going to put your head through the glass.
Right.
And you know.
Give me what you got.
Or you get on the subway and somebody would sit next to you and put their arm around you rather aggressively and say, you know, what's in your pocket? What's your name? Where are, you know, just be like asking you a lot of questions. And
yeah.
Just waiting, praying for the train to come out of the tunnel onto
right.
the platform, you know. I still remember that.
I mean, don't you think a skill set is born from being a kid in New York?
Yeah.
Your parents are not. They're doing their thing. They
yes.
trust the world, and you're surviving.
It's true. Yeah, back then, they weren't as, at least it didn't feel like it, they weren't as watchful as we are to our kids. You
no.
know, there wasn't.
No, they were not watchful at all.
Not,
let's be just
yeah,
really,
they were
really
kind of like,
they loved
go
us.
To the park
yeah.
and come back
yeah.
in time for dinner.
Right.
And that was it.
Would you even come back and say, I was mugged today on the subway, or just?
Once or twice, yeah. Sometimes like a police officer would come to our school and give us a talk, you know, how to react properly when you're being mugged.
Right.
And he said, always bring money with you.
Right.
Don't go out with no money.
Yep.
and immediately give it up.
Right.
And try to make the experience as fast as possible. Okay. The more time you're haggling or discussing, the more time you're in the situation, the worse. I always remembered that. So try to have it.
That's a good
reach
lesson.
Its conclusion.
Right.
Even if the conclusion is your own death, do it as quickly as possible.
When I was thinking about you, I was like, you know, did you ever have your heart broken in?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Everybody has a version of whatever pain they go through in life. And I didn't grow up with a lot of money. I grew up with very little money. In fact, I was raised until I was 10 years old by my mom as a single mom. She was got divorced when I was a little kid. And then she died when I was 10. And so then I had to go live with my dad, who was a great guy, but didn't have the capacity to kind of raise a kid. So then I was sort of raised by the community.
Right.
And that was the school that I went to. So there was a lot of, like, you know, kind of whatever emotions and experiences to unpack from just that over the course of a lifetime. Being raised by a single mom and being an only child. I have two half sisters, but they were out of the picture when I was being raised by my mom. The world was opportunity, you know, so it was like, go find a book, go to the library.
Right.
So I would go to the library and I'd go check out LPs of comedy things, and I would go get Cheech and Chong, and I would go get Bob Newhart, and I would go get Richard Pryor, and these were like wildly inappropriate, most of them, for a 7-year-old, 8-year-old.
Right.
But it was something to do.
Right.
And my mom it was free. Those are the other things. So it was like I was dependent upon the community, whether it was Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, whether it was community athletics. You know, you only had to pay $9 and I could play soccer for a season. And, you know, that included your uniform and all the other stuff that made you feel like you were good. And the coach was some divorced dad who didn't have anything else to do. And, you know, you weren't exactly training to be a professional soccer player, but it was something to do. So those were the kinds of things that I gravitated toward. And then my mom would put me in art classes and she'd put me in acting classes because she knew it was something to do, that I would have fun with it, that I could meet other kids, and that I would be, you know, and that she could then go to work. Right. She had to work, you know, from 9 to 5 every day. She was a secretary.
Yeah.
And so that was like, that was, again, and that's the idea of like in loco parentis, like that I was taken care of by the community, which is why when I talk about how much of a hometown kid I am, it's like, why I get back.
I went to LA when I was 19. I tried to go to college for like a semester after high school, which was a community college in New Jersey. And I studied, ironically, Russian history. I don't know what I was thinking or talking about. I was like filling a box of time because I was like, what am I going to do with my life? I'm not going to go to college really, but we thought maybe I should start because I was 18 and graduated from high school. And I think I just stayed in Morristown because I was dating this guy who lived in Morristown. And so that was like probably the real reason I stayed was because he was really hot.
Beautiful. Morristown's beautiful.
Yeah, but we weren't, you know, that wasn't why I stayed, for the beauty of Morristown. No. Then we broke up and I was like, what am I doing in New Jersey? I don't want to be here. I always wanted to move to Los Angeles. I had an aunt and uncle who lived in Bel Air. The first time I had come to Los Angeles, I was like 10 years old, and we came to visit my aunt and my mom's sister, and we got on an airplane, and it was the first time I had flown. I was like 10, and we walked past the first class section, and I was like, whoa, whoa, who are these people? Like, this looks like my group. And my mom was like, no, honey, we have 6 children. Like, we're never flying first class. This is a different section of the plane. And I was like, well, I don't know about that. Like, I feel like I belong there. So we went back, and then 2 years later, I had my second plane trip, but I had become a babysitter in between 10 and 12, and I saved up my money, and I purchased my own first class ticket from a neighbor down the street who was my friend's mom, who happened to be a travel agent. Okay. And then the next flight we took
as a family
with my mom, and I had 2 brothers with me who were all older. I'm the youngest. we get on the plane and it was my grandfather's funeral. He had died and we're flying to California and 2A was my seat. And I fucking plopped down and I was like, hey, I will see you guys at the end of the flight. And my mom was like, what are you doing? Chelsea, get up. I'm like, this is my ticket. I purchased it. And my older brother's like, oh my God, are you kidding me? He's like, you have to give that seat to mom. I'm like, no, I don't. Right. I purchased this. Right. This is my earned money. Right. Like a mom can sit in the back of the plane where she's, that's fine with her. This is where I belong.
Laurel Canyon, for many people, was a literal place, but also a metaphorical place. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the same thing. I knew that Carole King and Joni Mitchell and all these people that I loved were living up there. I have two stories about Laurel Canyon that are particular. Would you like to hear them?
Yes.
Okay. One is that in high school, Bobby Carradine, who was David Carradine's brother, and he was an actor also, went to my high school. He was a little bit older than I was, I think. And he asked me out on a date, and he had a little Alfa Romeo, like a red sports car. So he said, let's go for a ride, you know, just drive around. And I think it was a school night, so it was pretty early. Right. But we were driving around, and he says, well, let's go up and visit my brother. Now, his brother at the time was David Carradine, right. And he was doing the series Kung Fu.
Right.
Remember that?
Yes, I do.
So I said, sure. At that time, I had eaten at home. And he takes us up, and David was married to Barbara Hershey. So they were like, okay, let's go see what my brother's doing. So we show up, and they had a little baby, and the baby wasn't even walking. It was just a crawling baby, but it was Laurel Canyon. Right. They were hippies. Mm-hmm. It was not, they had a big, huge dog. It was not the cleanest of kitchens, let's say, but the baby was on the floor. And I took one look around, and I was like, oh, I'm not really, like, vibing with this whole, you know, like, not really clean vibe. So,
it's a little too hippie.
Yeah, but the baby is there and so cute, and she's making some kind of dinner, and, you know, we all sit down to eat, and they asked me if I wanted to eat, and I said no, because I had just eaten at my parents', right? So I said, thank you very much. And they, would you like something to drink? And I said, yes.
Right,
What could they do to get something to drink?
Right.
So she passes over a communal bowl of water.
Oh, this is amazing.
And so I did one of those fake things where you, like, pretend you're sipping, but you're really just, like, your lips are closed, like, you know, now during COVID, that wouldn't fly.
Right, not at all. Yeah.
The other Laurel Canyon story that's so great is, two of my best friends growing up were Catholic, and they went to a Catholic girls' school called Corvallis. It was on Laurel Canyon, just south of Ventura Boulevard. The building is still there, but it's not a girls' school anymore.
Right.
And one of their best friends there was Melanie Griffith. So I met Melanie when I was like 16 or 17 years old, right? And Melanie was dating Don Johnson at that time already. Mm-hmm. And Don had a house in Laurel Canyon. So Melanie and Don were seeing each other. And we were over there one day. And it was cold. It was Don's house, but Melanie was still in high school, but it was also kind of random because she was still dating Don. So I don't know if she lived at home or she lived with Don at that time.
It was very free love.
Very free love.
Yeah.
So Melanie says to Don, Donnie, it's cold. Can you light a fire? And he says, yeah, sure. So we girls are outside. We're doing something. We're laughing, whatever. We hear some noise. We don't think much of it. We come back in, and there's a gorgeous fire roaring in this Laurel Canyon cottage. And Melanie says, where'd you get the firewood? He says, I chopped up one of the chairs. Which he did. He chopped up one of the dining room chairs.
What was happening?
I don't know.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring?
but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver.
Yeah! I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger, and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
Thanks for joining us for our look back at the first season of Table for Two. One thing that ties all my guests together is their ability to harness their creativity and turn it into beautiful work, whether it's on the page, on the runway, or on the screen. We've heard pieces of advice and insight into the creative process. In this section, we'll hear from Emily Blunt, Tom Ford, Anna Wintour, and Octavia Spencer.
Do you find being a mother, being a professional person,
yes.
it's toll. You just it's
it an does.
So and how
it
do
doesn't
you manage all that?
Well, not always well. You right. know, it's one of those things when people are like, how do you balance it? I never feel I'm doing it right. You know, but this year I'm not working. I just need to be.
Really?
Yeah, I just need to. I worked quite a bit last year.
Yeah.
And my oldest baby is 9.
Right.
Like we're in the last year of single digits. Mm-hmm. And I just feel there's cornerstones to their day that are so important when they're little.
Yes.
And it's, will you wake me up? Will you take me to school? Will you pick me up? Will you put me to bed?
Right.
And I just need to be there for all of them
yeah.
for a good stretch.
Yeah.
And I just felt that in my bones. I had a beautiful time on the projects I did last year. Some were more intense than others. Some were harder than others. Some were more time consuming than others. And the ones that are time consuming, I think for me, are becoming few and further between because of just the emotional cost on me, on the kids, on balance.
Yeah.
And I'm very prone to guilt, and I think maybe all mothers are.
Yeah.
You're just prone to feeling bad for, mm-hmm. God forbid, wanting something outside of being a mother.
Right.
I am a huge advocate for it. I'm a huge advocate for women being ambitious. I love the word ambition. It's just dreams with purpose. That's all it is. It's not an ugly word.
I love that definition.
It is. That's what it is. That's what
it
means.
Yes.
And it's just... And I want my kids to grow up and find something that they adore doing.
And your kids watching you do something that you adore
yeah.
is so important.
It's so important. And, of course, they're just horrified by the fact that I'm an actress and just sort of so embarrassed by it and have no desire to watch me in anything, which is very healthy
because
right, yeah. they just want me to be their mum.
Sure.
So the balance is... usually it sways in extremes. Like, I'll work too much and then I'll have, like, a complete... reaction against it and
right.
an aversion to being on a film set for a long time.
Right.
And then I'll want to desperately work again.
Right.
So I don't know if I do it moderately. I think I just have these pulls towards it and against it.
You know, I am a creative director. I am used to working with the very best people in fashion, let's just say. Let's start with fashion. The very best people. You have to have a vision. You have to know what you want to say as a fashion designer. But you have to lead and inspire this group of people. Fashion design, I mean, you know, assistant designers, seamstresses, hair and makeup people, lighting people. You have to get the best out of them. So you have to inspire them and, you know, let them express themselves. But at the same time, you have to sort of corral it all and focus it into your vision, which is, in my case, somewhat singular. You know, fashion is not a democracy. It's a dictatorship. And in the end, you know, if I design something, it's because that's exactly the way I want it. I've been called a control freak. I hate that word. But I think if my name is on something, it needs to be exactly the way I want it. So,
yes,
others, somebody else can say, maybe it should be like this. And I say, no, it should be like that. Or, yes, a great idea.
Right.
So the same is true with film. As a film director, it's the same process. You have to have a vision. You have to know what you want to say. You have to hire the best people, bring out the best in them, the best actors, the best cinematographer, the best of everything. But yet you have to steer it all in a way that expresses your point of view and that you don't lose. So the process is not dissimilar. Also, the thing about fashion is we have, people don't realize fashion designers have an enormous hard drive loaded with images from almost every film that's ever been made. You know, when we start a collection, we pull images from, you know, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and most of them are from film or they're from, you know, so we have a grasp on culture, contemporary culture, past culture that I don't think most people realize. And that's very helpful when you're making a film.
My question really is, with, you know, having the job you do, which is the, you know, chief content officer for Condé Nast, you're so busy. How do you make time for friends, to give advice to people? How does that come into your life in such a way?
I'm so lucky that I have the platform that I do, and it does put me in a position to help people and to connect people, and I get huge amount of pleasure, whether it's working with my chiefs of content around the world or you or whoever it may be, in learning about their lives and what they're thinking and what they're doing. And if there is any way that one can be helpful, I feel, you know, I had amazing people that helped me when I was starting out, and I think it doesn't require anything but one's time. And I think that's just so important to give when people are rushing so madly. And I also think, particularly right now when things are so tough and we've all come out of COVID and the world is in the state that it's in, that to make time to help and connect people if one can is so important. I also think it's really, really important to be focused, because you can't do everything and you can't help everyone. Yes. So you think about where you do have areas of expertise, or you can put people in touch that will be meaningful. So I think being focused and being clear and also being transparent, people respond to that. I've worked in my career with and for people that maybe haven't necessarily been that clear, and it's incredibly frustrating. And I think as long as people know it's a yes or it's a no, or I can help you, or I'm really sorry, I'd love to help you, but I'm not able to, is better than pretending or faking. And so that's what I try as much as possible to do, because I have been at the other end when people have made promises or sort of not been clear on what they're saying or doing. And you just waste everybody's time.
I think, especially given where we are with technology and social media, there are steps in the process, I think, that people want to skip, because it's about fame sometimes, and it's about being out there. Oh, you know, no one has noticed me yet. And I think you have to be prepared, because you don't know when that opportunity is going to come. So you have to study. And when you think about it, I remember my mom, and it was the most practical advice she has ever given. And it's just part of my, it's my mantle, you know. Whenever you, if you're the first job you ever get, if it's a fry cook, if it's a newspaper boy, someone's going to train you on how to do it. This is how you sell your newspaper. This is how you cook my fries.
Right.
Whatever else it is, whatever field of study, you're going to have to train.
Yeah.
And so take the time, because if you're 3 years in, if you're 15 years in, if you're 1 year in, if you don't have the comfort of training, that's your foundation. And if you don't have, you know, your land legs, when that opportunity presents itself,
yeah,
it could mean failure.
Yeah, because if you don't build upon it, you don't have the goods. You don't have the foundation.
You have to have that foundation, because whatever it is, you know, everybody feels like an imposter.
Yeah,
you know. Right. So if you haven't done the best to prepare for whatever it is, you can't be a doctor without going to med school.
Right.
You know what I mean? Nobody's gonna let you doctor on them.
Right. And the fool that does might not get off the table.
Exactly.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver.
Yeah! I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger, and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
Thanks for joining us on Table for Two. Today, we're looking back at all the great interviews and meals we've shared this year. Almost every guest on the show has had an amazing story of making it big. Sometimes it's a realization that they've just gotten their breakthrough role, or that they've been part of something that has had a huge cultural impact. Let's hear stories from our interviews with Rob Lowe, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Julia Roberts with George Clooney.
You know, your memoir really goes deep into the audition process and then the actual shooting process with Francis Ford Coppola, which is like crazy what he made you guys do. And like, because that was like the first really big moment.
My first movie.
That was your first movie. So you'd done really smaller
ever.
Stuff.
I'd done a sitcom on ABC, and I played like the teenage son, and it ran for like 6 episodes and was canceled. And then I'd done some after school specials, if you remember those.
I remember those.
Wednesdays on 3 o'clock.
I remember yours. It was a big deal.
It was a big one, but
I'd
never done a movie.
Right.
And you know, sitcoms and after school specials are not movies.
Right.
And they're certainly not Francis Ford Coppola.
No.
And you know, Coppola at that, still one of our great filmmakers.
Yeah.
At that moment, he was only a few years off of making Apocalypse Now.
Right.
And, you know, and of course, got The Godfathers. And so here's this very, very lauded, serious filmmaker doing a movie where all the roles are 15, 16, 17 year olds.
Right.
And, you know, all the kid actors were like, this is the, it's the gold, the Willy Wonka gold ticket.
Yeah.
That everybody wanted. And
you talk about the auditions and you reference in the auditions. So there's the West Coast guys that are auditioning and the New York actors. I love this because it really makes you work for this. The West Coast actors were you, Emilio.
Emilio. Weirdly enough, Tom, because he was staying out here with Emilio. So okay. Cruz was out here, even though he was East Coast. Pony Boy, Tommy Howell.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to the East Coast, and that's where Matt Dillon was.
Right.
Ralph Macchio played Johnny.
Right.
And we went through this whole process, months of audition. Months and months and months and months.
Mm-hmm.
And then he picked his favorites, and then he took us to New York, and it was the same thing there. But it wasn't months, it was, you know, a week.
Right.
And then, but we did, I mean, there's more filmed footage of us auditioning than there probably is of us making the actual movie.
So the process of that film, when your sons look at that movie, what was their reaction to that movie?
Well, I'm not sure how much of anything of mine my sons have actually seen. I actually do think they've all seen The Outsiders because, much to their mortification, they had to read the book and see the movie in class.
Right. Right, it is. That's a...
Seventh grade.
Yep,
It's in the curriculum across the country for the most part. And, and there's nothing I love more than going into a seventh grade class after they've seen the movie or and read the book and talking to them. I love it.
Right.
And I love it because I love kids. But also, it's a new crop of fans. I mean, to be able... as you know, the key to longevity is you can't... If your audience ages out, you're done.
You're done.
So the key to a long career is... if you're lucky enough to figure it out, having a new crop of people discover you every year, and The Outsiders does that by design.
What was the toughest part when you were in production with that?
The night shoots. You know, I mean, I'd never made a movie, so the notion of shooting all night in the rain and the fight, the big rumble scene was a whole week of shooting all at night, with freezing cold, no dressing rooms, nowhere. Francis was very mercurial. He would treat the cast great, and then... wouldn't provide anywhere for us to get warm.
Right.
I mean, Francis had all of these great...
That's hysterical.
...social engineering experiments he wanted to try. He had us playing tackle football.
Yeah.
In the street. And I'll never forget Tommy Howell played Pony Boy. His dad was one of the great stuntmen.
Yeah.
Chris Howell, legendary stuntman. So Tommy knew his way around, even though he was only 15.
Uh-huh.
And he huddled us up and said, listen... I'm calling this game. We're done here. Because if I break my leg on this next football play, I'll be on the next flight home and somebody else will be playing Pony Boy.
Right.
My favorite thing, though, Francis wanted us to learn about being greasers by talking to people who were greasers in the 50s. So me and Cruz were hooked up with this family and had to go spend the night at their house in the basement. And I can just remember lying in this cot in the basement of a house in Tulsa with a family I never knew and just looking over at Tom and going, what the fuck are we doing? Yeah. It was, I mean, I understand why Francis did it. I get it, but it's very odd and not the way most people make movies.
Were you amazed at the effect that you had in New York with style and with women and men in the 90s, I really, you know, you're credited and justifiably so for really shifting a whole conversation and look. Was there a moment that you looked across the street and saw somebody and you're like, she's dressed like Carrie Bradshaw?
Yeah, I think over time, and I will say that really is Pat Field and Molly Rogers originally. You know, Pat was our original costume designer, as you know. She's incredible. Molly Rogers was there from day one of the original show. So I think what we all recognized, the ways in which the show was influencing life, whether it was the flower, you know, or the Carrie nameplate, or, you know, walking down the street with two purses versus one, or two pocketbooks versus one pocketbook, or. You'd start to see young women gathered 4 and 5 on a Sunday for brunch.
Right.
And you'd just see more of it, or groups of women walking. You'd see a kind of emotional life that wasn't as visible in certain ways. But the clothes had a huge impact. And I think that was because Pat never, and Molly Putt, they never felt that they had to answer to anybody or apologize. I'll speak specifically to Carrie, who has a very specific relationship with fashion, as well vintage. So I think, you know, there were lots of hits, and there were, in many people's opinion, lots of misses. And to us, none of it was a mistake.
Right.
Like, you had to take an approach and be totally monogamous to an aesthetic idea.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, like in anything, it's arresting. You know, if somebody writes a book and uses a voice that you've never read before, everybody's going to talk about it.
Yeah.
Or think of early images on MTV and what made us all stop.
Yep.
And watch a video 100 times. You know, music, architecture,
mm-hmm.
you know, anything that feels fresh, unique, yet unseen, but not arbitrarily so. You can't just be ridiculous because you can be.
Right.
And it really doesn't look like there's any point of view or perspective. It looks just like you're trying to be
right, provocative.
And, exactly. Right. Like, so I feel like the things that were influential were because they were a real choice.
Yeah.
And then you know, in the beginning, I've told this story many times, that we didn't have anything in the beginning. Nobody would loan us anything. We were getting most of Carrie's wardrobe from vintage and consignment shops and Century 21.
Wow.
Occasionally, we could afford a dress off the rack at right. a finer department store yeah. like Saks.
Right.
Like but the wedding,
like
very
the dress
rare.
For the Palazzo.
That was the most expensive dress they right. ever bought. It was a Christian Dior simple sheath
yeah.
dress. I've heard it was anywhere from $600 to $800, but right. that would have been like...
Yeah.
You'd be making decisions then. Okay, well, if we get that, then we can't have that. Like, that wasn't a loan.
Right.
That was a
purchase.
Buy.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you the story. You've probably heard the story 1,000 years ago, but once upon a time, I was in Europe with friends, and it just so happened that we went on an Audrey Hepburn movie marathon binge for like a long weekend.
And where are you? What part of Europe?
I was in London.
Okay.
And flying back to America, and I get on the plane and I get myself situated. Now, me on an airplane is about 5 seconds of buckling my seatbelt and, you know, 11 and a half hours of sleeping.
Right, okay.
And I get on the plane and I get all, you know, situated and stuff, and I'm sitting there and I was in first class.
Yes.
Good. Ooh.
Yes, good. Very, very fancy, and not a lot of people in first class. And I look over, so I'm sitting in a window seat.
Oh,
there's
my God,
a seat next to me,
tell me,
and there's
oh
middle
God.
Section, and then over there is Audrey Hepburn.
Wow.
And I honestly, it's like, am I making this up?
Right.
Is she really there?
Yeah.
Is she? And I just, it's like, go to sleep. You gotta go to sleep. Like, I didn't know what to do with myself.
Right.
Anyway, I was beside myself. Yeah. Beside myself. And should I talk to her? Should I not talk to her? I can't talk to her. I can't talk to her. I walk up to her and go, hi, I'm an actor and I just love you. And I just didn't know what to do. So I did fall asleep. And then when I wake up, when the wheels touch the ground, which is my
it's amazing
MO.
That
yeah.
you can do that. Wow.
Thank you. And I think, okay, there's long lines at customs.
Right.
I will pull myself together, put a piece of gum in my mouth,
mm-hmm.
and say hello.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, she doesn't have an American passport.
Oh, no.
She's
at yeah, another place.
Somewhere else. Yeah.
She's in the other line.
And I missed my chance. My chance is over. And I'm so disappointed in myself. And really disappointed.
Yeah.
And I go downstairs, because this was back in the day when I checked a bag. And I go down to baggage claim,
mm-hmm.
and I get my bag. And as I turn around, because, you know, the guy takes your ticket and looks at the thing, standing right in front of me with her checked bag is Audrey Hepburn.
Right.
And she turns to me and she goes, you're wonderful.
Wow.
With
wow.
her arms out like this and hugs me.
Oh.
And I was just like...
Oh,
I just thought, she yeah. has no idea. She has no idea what is happening to my
yeah.
entire life right now.
Yeah.
And I had to call my friends and like, so every movie there was Charade. I was like, she is right there. You know, I just could not
believe
wow,
it.
Wow, what yeah. a cool story. And like, yet again, timing. It wasn't meant to be on the plane. That's
it
what
was
it was meant
so
to be.
So magnificent. And unbeknownst to any of us at the time, she was unwell.
Yeah.
And she was given a Screen Actors Guild Lifetime Achievement Award in back in the day when they were these kind of smaller things, whatever. And she wrote me a letter and asked me to receive it on her behalf.
Oh.
And she wrote a speech and asked me to recite the speech. And Gregory Peck presented
it. Dear friends.
And it was just, I my whole life, I just thought, what is happening right now? Gregory Peck is, I'm sort of the proxy for Audrey Hepburn. What is going on? And I read this beautiful speech that she'd written. I mean, it was...
That's
I kind of forget
story.
That that even happened to me because
really?
It was so, it just sounds like fiction.
Yeah.
Like, it, oh, so I'm on this plane. And, you know, I mean, it just,
that's wild.
It sounds like a made up story,
that
but
is
it
incredible.
All happened.
I love that. And she was, you know, I mean, honest to God, when you look at like the epitome of class.
Class.
You know, she just was so elegant. And she was elegant from Roman Holiday on.
Yeah.
Just went
and
from there.
And UNICEF and all of it.
Sure.
I mean, amazing.
As we wind down our retrospective, I want to bring it back to the heart of the show, food. Let's go back to the very beginning and hear a clip from our first episode ever with Scarlett Johansson at Via Carota. Oh, and spoiler alert, I'm actually sitting at the Carlisle Hotel right now recording another interview for our next season coming in 2024. So thanks again for pulling up a chair, and we'll see you next year.
Let's talk about food for a second. You know, I grew up in a house where we never saw my dad. He was always in the restaurant, so we never had dinner together. As a family, my mother would cook. Can you kind of just paint the picture of the young siblings kind of in... Because you guys grew up in Chelsea.
We grew up in the West Village.
West Village.
And, well, yeah, I mean, we moved around a lot before that, but we eventually settled in the West Village when I was, like, 10. And we lived in a lower middle-income housing project. And yeah, we didn't eat out ever because we never had money to. My mom did most of the cooking at home when I was little, and she had her kind of meals on rotation. I think she enjoyed cooking to some extent. My dad really enjoyed cooking. My dad was a really great cook. His first wife was Italian and like made an amazing like Putinesque and all those like delicious sauces.
Yeah.
Like my dad was great at that, and we all love to eat. Like my family is a foodie family. We, you know, my sister and I both look like love to cook together. My sister is an excellent cook.
You growing up in New York, I feel like if we were decades apart but in the same borough, I would have loved you. You would have been, I would have been your gay best friend.
Well, 100%.
I'm really honored that
you're an amazing interviewer.
I am?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's so natural,
really?
And it's like butter. It's wonderful.
You know, it's very,
like butter.
Yeah, I mean, exactly, but it's very easy to sit with someone you love or you admire.
Thank you.
I hope that everyone enjoyed today. Thank you for
pulling
up a
chair. It was wonderful. Thank you so much for this highly carby lunch, and I love it.
You deserve
you
every
it.
Carb.
Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi is produced by iHeartRadio, 737 Park, and Airmail. Our executive producers are Bruce Bozzi and Nathan King. Table for Two is researched and written by Bridget Arsenault. Our sound engineers are Paul Bowman and Alyssa Midgaff. Table for Two's LA production team is Danielle Romo and Lorraine Virez. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our talent booking is by Jane Sarkin. Special thanks to Amy Sugarman, Uni Scher, Kevin Uvain, Bobby Bauer, Allison Cantor-Graber, Barbara and Jen, and Jeff Klein and the staff at the Tower Bar in the world-famous Sunset Tower Hotel, Jody Williams, Rita Sodi, and the team at Via Carota in Manhattan's West Village,
And a special thank you to all the people who work at the Lobster Roll, better known as Lunch on Montauk Highway, and a special shout out to Andrea. Thank you so much.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful fingersticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.